Welcome to a new episode of Working Media with Rafael Bracero. Today's guest is Brian Weiser, who has often been called Madison Avenue's de facto chief economist and is a highly respected figure in the media and entertainment industry. We're going to have a very rangy conversation, which will include Brian's perspective on these years' upfronts, new fronts, and other fronts, so many of these days, in a year where there's been a good amount of disruption that has certainly been ongoing, from writer strikes to kind of like the, you know, part two of the streaming wars, to tech reorgs, to new measurement currencies being floated about. So it's going to be really interesting. We're going to kind of go deep into that water. And we'll also get to have an opportunity to learn more about Brian and his path in the industry. So just to give you a little bit of a backgrounder, so Brian started as a media analyst, and most recently, he actually, before he's doing this cool new venture that he's going to talk to us about, he was global president for business intelligence at Group M, which is obviously a big ad agency giant. And currently, he launched earlier in the year, I think it was in January, he launched Madison and Wall, which aims to provide insights and strategic guidance for investors, private equity, and then obviously for the industry. And he's been doing this for quite a while in other roles, and has a very well-received newsletter, back, including from Madison and Wall, but then also back to his days working at Pivotal and some of his other opportunities. So he also happens to also be a CMO. He was a CMO at Semel Media, which, you know, obviously, as this is a marketing podcast, we'll dig into that experience. And worked before that, he worked at Interpublix Magna as an analyst for that ad agency. But before that, he got his start working as both starting as an investment analyst with as a management investment as an associate investment banker with Lehman Brothers, which I have some questions about Lehman, a very interesting firm, and then also as a research analyst at Deutsche, which I'm assuming this is when you got your CFA and your Institute of Investors rankings and all that stuff. So lots of interesting background there. Basically worked in the media segment for the most part. Anyway, so he's had a very kind of influential path in his career, and we're very happy to have him. So welcome to the podcast, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So I'm always very interested in beginnings. And so I wanted to start with something like from very early in your career. So now you're from Canada, right? British Columbia, or you went to school in British Columbia?
Vancouver, BC.
All right, so you know, nice guy from Canada. You actually started in radio, in the radio industry.
Well, you could call it an industry, but it's you know, campus community radio certainly would consider itself to be not an industry per se. Although certainly it was a distinct regulated sector of the of radio in Canada. that was. It was something that I and certainly many hundreds of other volunteers were, you know, actively engaged in at the University of British Columbia, and many, many thousands across Canada and tens of thousands, I'm sure, across the United States at the same time. And but yeah, very interested in, you know, the mission around campus community radio, but originally kind of just fell into it because a friend and I, we wanted to create our own version of Crossfire.
Really interesting.
Let us there. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you from what I read about you, you actually created one of the first radio station internet sites back in 93, which reminded me of broadcast.com, which I think was like maybe 2 years later. I think they had AudioNet was kind of the precursor to broadcast.com. And then they took some of the content that was on radio and then they digitized it and put it on the internet. So I don't know if that was part of what you were doing, but you're definitely ahead of your time there.
Well, I mean, there are a handful of other college radio stations in the United States that were ahead of us, and certainly were entities I was looking to for guidance. WXDU and I guess at Durham, in North Carolina. I think you had Lawrence, Kansas's station, and then WPRB in Princeton. I think those are the first three, and we just couldn't find the money to actually like stream. But it was something we were trying to figure out how to do. And this is before there was a website. Like, there was no web. It didn't exist. It was the internet, but it wasn't the web.
Right. So right. Like, I think Netscape came out, what, in 95, something like that?
I think it was sometime in 94, but it was, yeah. If my memory serves correctly. But no, this was a site that was built in Gopher.
Wow, okay.
So it's going way back. Yeah, and definitely you could see some of the possibilities. And of course, in our very I don't know, not very good foresight, we thought, oh, this is great. It's democratizing distribution of information, and there won't be any global conglomerates taking over this part of the world.
Oh yeah. See how that happened, right? Okay, well, and then going all the way to the present. So so tell us a little bit more about Madison Wall.
Well, providing strategic advisory services, consulting, for lack of a better word, to anyone who calls. No, I mean, clearly there's a niche that I've carved out that focuses on the advertising industry. And I certainly have a very detailed view about how the industry is evolving. And it's always interesting to find, you know, different questions that I can help answer. And in parallel, I'm continuing to publish research through my Substack at mastermall.substack.com. And that is really just, it's me continuing to keep smart about the business and the industry, the research that I need to do to just keep on top of things. It's not a lot of extra work to then turn that into an external product. So why not?
Absolutely. And how do you, I mean, obviously, especially being a former equity analyst and then an analyst for the ad industry, you must have an extensive number of sources that you go to, but which are like the sources that are the ones that you tend to gravitate to first in terms of the type of work that you're doing?
I mean, it just depends on the question I'm trying to answer, right? I mean, you'll see something on, you know, the advertising agency industry where maybe the historical data might include the data from the Census Bureau, or it might include, you know, certainly securities filings are critical for a lot of the work that I do. LinkedIn is a tremendous source of data if it's interpreted correctly. So it really just depends on the question I'm trying to answer or explore.
Right. And then just coming back a little bit to your beginning, your career in iBanking, both on the equity research side and then also on the origination side, what led you to kind of migrate over to what you ended up doing later on?
Well, I, as an investment banker doing work around media and advertising, you had one source of data in the early 2000s that related to how big the advertising industry was, how fast it was growing. It was Bob Cohen at McCann Erickson. That's it. There was no other real source. And then the opportunity came my way to replace him. And I thought, oh, wow, that's kind of cool. I took it.
So tell us a little bit more about him, because I don't think you know, some of the folks in our audience might not be familiar with him. So tell a little bit of kind of a background about him as well.
Yeah, well, anyone who relies on data related to the advertising industry, whether it's in the United States or globally, prior to around 2000, there is only one source. Everything resolves back to Bob's data. That's it. Because he started working at McCann Erickson in 1948. And he had built out some early data of advertising in the, well, basically from immediately before the Depression, Great Depression until post-World War II. and continued building out this data inside of McCann. And then it was a core data set that Interpublic used when they eventually went public in the mid late 60s. It was a way to talk about the industry without talking about their own company directly. And then, of course, as other media companies either became public or wanted to have points of reference, they cited the data. And before you know it, all of Wall Street's relying on this data. There were others that eventually launched with an advertising forecast product, Zenith, inside of Publicis now, had one from the mid-90s. They were maybe the second. Group M eventually had their own advertising forecast product a few years after that. But, if you look at, why does anyone know how big the advertising industry is? There are different sources or underlying sources in individual countries, but there are only really a handful of global sources. And everyone basically is borrowing off of them unless they've gone to the trouble of, having knowledge and depth of data on 60 or so countries around the world. And so that was basically the data set that I was able to, I re-engineered it, rebuilt it, but it still had this legacy that was pretty tremendous.
Right. So it's quite concentrated data. So I wanted to pivot over to the upfronts and kind of get your, since we're talking about kind of historical data here, how have you seen the upfronts evolve over the years? And what are the recent trends that you're seeing, particularly for this year, from what you experienced?
Well, upfronts have always served a purpose. I came into the agency world in 2003 knowing nothing about them or how TV was bought and sold. And, I realized there wasn't a lot of history on it that was in one place. So I remember early in my agency career going to the Forays library and going through every back issue of Ad Age and Ad Week and everything I could find back to the 1960s to read up as much history as I could. And certainly talking to someone like Bob, who, again, we overlapped for a few years, I'd get a bit of historical context. The one thing that I was able to piece together was that, upfronts always served a very important purpose, which was helping a marketer just make a plan and get a commitment of access to inventory so that they could build everything else around that thing that was so critical to their marketing goals. And it's always served that purpose. Anytime anyone would say, oh, it's an antiquated thing or whatever, it's like, okay, that's coming from a place of ignorance. It's kind of like saying my water faucet, which is over 100 years old as a concept, is antiquated. Well, yes, but it also works an awful lot better than, let's say, a drone that would deliver a bucket over a river and fly it back here. Sure, that might include some new technology, but it's really inefficient. And so it's worth noting that just because it's old and it's just because it's a fixed process doesn't mean it's bad at all. So in the sense that upfronts have served a purpose, and they still continue to serve a purpose, in that sense, they haven't really changed that much. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's different inventory that's included depending on who is selling it. That's also been true when, broadcast networks bought cable networks. As time progressed, maybe the cable networks weren't anywhere near as scarce as the broadcast networks, but if you could make the buyer of that inventory better off by including it in the negotiations, then the advertiser would take it. And over time, advertisers would say, well, yeah, we want to lay down as much of our overall TV plans as possible. Okay. And therefore, why not book it all at the same time as much as possible? Then you get to the world of connected TV, where the bulk of that inventory is not sold programmatically. So why wouldn't you include that too? In that sense, it's just part of the continuum of how this is evolving. I think some of the myths around why upfronts are archaic presupposes that it's actually possible to execute a plan in real time in media. And it's really not and won't likely be ever. Like, you can't go from plan to buy for stuff that's scarce without, like, without a lot of notice. That's just the way the world works.
Right. And but I mean, I also think that there's probably some pushback in terms of the timing that it takes to put these plans together, right? I mean, if you're buying media, and you know, even once you go through the process of buying it, it'll still, even the reporting for the metrics on it might be a couple of weeks, and then if you're running studies on it, then it's even longer. So I think that's maybe where, like, there's a little bit pushback on the more digital programmatic side, where they're speeding that up. But I mean, you're not necessarily getting, you're getting the audiences, but you're not maybe getting the programs necessarily that you want to have affiliate with your brand as well.
But the programs are less, the programs are less important than the access to inventory.
Correct. Right. And the scale of that access.
Yeah. Right? Especially for larger firms. You can't do that in real time.
Right. So so staying with the linear side, so broadcast and cable, what is the kind of, like, from a dollar growth standpoint, what does that look like this year, year over year?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about the upfronts, I don't have any unique insight as to what's happening. I rely on reporting, gossip, and other sources as much as anyone else who's not in the middle of negotiations does. You know, it probably sounds like it'll be down slightly, but here's the thing. Again, as an analyst covering the stocks associated with the advertising industry, the one point I always try to emphasize was that if you ever see a stock moving in response to the upfront, take the other side of that trade, because there is no correlation between what happens in the upfront and what happens in terms of actual revenue the full year. It's just not meaningful. Again, right. It's meaningful to advertisers. It's not meaningful to investors. It's not meaningful to the overall industry.
Right. And this is coming from someone who runs a lot of regressions on a daily basis. So,
well, I mean, I built out the data sets that try to map these things together, right. In a relationship.
Right. How about, like, the CPMs? How are you seeing? I think I remember one of your pieces recently talked about that the CPMs have actually increased somewhat.
Yeah, I can find a relationship between change in volumes negotiated at the time of the upfront and prices that will be experienced in the upfront. That's the model works pretty well. But again, you could argue it doesn't matter. That's the funny thing. Like, investors in particular would fixate on CPMs to a degree that's unnatural, because their models are built on CPMs. The problem is they don't seem to understand, for the most part, and frankly, people in the industry mostly don't understand, that pricing is an output, not an input to a model. Meaning, for a given amount of dollars, prices will be some number. If your goal is to figure out the dollars, the actual revenues, then you don't care or shouldn't care about pricing as much, if at all. Of course, an advertiser is trying to figure out how much inventory do I get? How many GRPs will I get? What will my reach and frequency look like? And for them, it's like the pricing does matter a fair amount. But even then, prices can go up. And as, again, Bob Cohen told me once when explaining what happened in the 1950s, when CPM inflation, price inflation was like 50% or some ridiculous number. I said, my God, Bob, how did advertisers manage that? And he said, well, it's simple. We invented the flight. Right? Basically going from, like, being always on to being on every second day, or not buying every network all the time. Like, okay, and boom, you just cut your...
Which was probably good, because probably their frequency is probably out of whack to begin with anyway, so...
Sure, but the point is that you can have prices going up by 50% or 100%. It doesn't mean that the budgets change. The budget is what the budget is. So if you're someone who's looking at the industry to understand the money, the actual dollars in an absolute sense, going up or down, ignore the pricing. It's not relevant.
So ignore the pricing and focus on what?
Well, it depends who you are. If you're trying to understand the industry and the industry's health, you want to focus on the revenue that's getting generated. And that, for that, like, upfront doesn't give you much information, because you have so much flow throughout the year. Scatter budgets, yes, but you also have slippage, right? The spread between what gets negotiated in the upfront, what actually goes to contract. Then you have options that get exercised, and you have no idea what the pricing is between an upfront advertiser versus a scatter advertiser, let alone if the mix changes, because higher paying advertisers who are new to the market show up in the upfront and lower paying advertisers get out. Like, you don't know what that mix is.
Right.
And so, there's no way to know it.
So focusing on the scatter ad market for a little bit. So what is that looking like right now?
I don't have data on this myself. It's we can point to reporters who are writing about it. It sounds like it's softer than it has been. Yeah. But again, I don't even track it. As an analyst, I didn't care to track it because it didn't tell me anything that was useful to investors.
Interesting. So so essentially the things that you're focusing is more like on the revenue side. So what about something like the actual level of inventory? Has that, I mean, that's, it keeps expanding, I would imagine.
No, it's declining. I mean, overall, because at the end of the day, I think viewing of television is falling. I mean, if you look at any data from Nielsen, I mean, certainly consumption trends are not terribly positive, if at all. And then as you start to think about, let's separate the viewing trends on a year-over-year basis that might not be apples to apples, like because of a methodological change.
So the viewership is lower, but the number of shows has increased. It's just the fact that you also have this incidence of like lower viewership, right?
No, well, I don't tend to think in terms of viewership. I certainly, when I'm looking at the industry, I tend to think of person hours of viewing and then person hours of viewing of ad supported content. Now, because viewership, as you just mentioned, could that mean the average viewing per program? I mean, that means something, but that's not an industry wide thing. So I tend to think, if, you know, just round numbers, the average person watches, call it 1500 hours of TV per year. And there's 300 million people, that's 450 billion person hours. I wish that the industry was thinking in those kinds of numbers, right? And start from that. And then you could say, okay, of the, in that case, 450 billion person hours, X percent of them are ad supported. Okay, so that's some number. It's 350 billion. Okay, and of that, 20% of that or some percentage is advertising. So call that 70 billion person hours of ad inventory. Now we can start to then cut it and say, okay, in terms of adults 18 to 49, well, that's some percentage, call it 25% of it. So now it's like 14 billion person hours. All right, now let's talk about the person hours of adults 18 to 49 inventory and whether that's going up or down. That would be a much more interesting way to talk about it and make sure that the industry is more uniform in thinking about it that way. But unfortunately, people are going to talk ratings, which is kind of that's an archaic way to talk about the industry, in my opinion.
And how about just in terms of the specific studios and broadcasters, anything that comes to mind, any particular trends that you've seen with, like, let's say Disney or Discovery or you know, obviously, you know, now obviously with Warner and Fox, and what do you see there in terms of differences in how they're approaching their various upfronts?
Well, I think from what I pay attention to, I'd point to the commoditization of it all, frankly. I mean, of course, there's subtle differences, but mostly it's just a GRP is a GRP wherever you find it. And so the only thing that really matters is, again, we're not in a world where any one network has a massive quantity of must buy programming in a way that, you know, would make everyone stampede towards that singular network. And so in that sense, like, studying the business is kind of easy because all you need to know is how many GRPs is one, what's the share of GRPs that one network is producing. Obviously, if you own wider reaching GRPs, that's advantageous. But, you know, we're transitioning from a world where marketers who bought upfront inventory cared a lot about the individual programs that they thought they were getting in their negotiations to a world where not only do you not know if the show is going to be running, but the ratings of individual programs are so low that it's really, it just doesn't matter. It's not like you're building a campaign around your association with an individual program. So we are right. moving towards a world where there is an increasing focus, if you will, on the audience and its characteristics more than the programs.
Right. And I mean, I'm assuming also there's probably like a lot of make goods as well, that because maybe some of these shows are not reaching their target viewing levels.
Well, that depends. I have not ever seen good public data on the ratings gap, right? Remember, the way that this works is let's take a fun anecdote. When I learned about this for the first time, I remember the year 2004, I sat in on a presentation from one of the syndicators that was going to bring some popular show, hour-long program, to syndication, and it was going to be airing like Saturday nights at 11 p.m. or something like that. But it was still like, it was a big program. It was kind of a big deal in that world. And I remember someone asking, and what would the guarantee be of the ratings of that program? And they said, we'll be guaranteeing a 2.0. And everyone else in the room was just broke out in laughter. I said, what's so funny? It's like, well, even Saturday Night Live doesn't normally get more than a 1 or 1.5 rating. And so the whole premise was that when they say they're guaranteeing a 2.0 or something, and you know there's no way they're getting more than half of that audience, that ratings gap is a way that they collect more money for this programming that they think is lucrative. And the buyer knows that they're going to get make goods as part of it. That part of the overall negotiation. The seller gets that extra flexibility to move the money around to other inventory. And that's just part of the overall negotiation. Anyways, the ratings gaps, I've never seen any of that information public ever. So it's hard to really know what's intentional, what's not intentional. There's always some intentional amount of make goods, but how much is unintentional, it's just impossible to know.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think also with especially with the make goods, sometimes they might not be one for one. Right. So then you're getting inventory that comes at a much later date that's outside of your campaign window or has some other issues with it. So it's interesting. It's really baked into the pricing, essentially, what you're saying. So very, very.
Again, separate pricing from the dollar volume commitment.
Right.
Pricing is what you pay for the gross rating points that you're getting. But when you give a higher guarantee of GRPs that you're going to deliver, you're getting a higher volume of dollars, a total dollars committed to a given supplier. But the pricing isn't impacted, really.
Got it.
It's more about a way that they can manage. You know, it was a way to manage the heightened demand that an individual seller might have, and a way to generate more value for themselves by, you know, especially if they have a lot of undifferentiated, if they have some really differentiated inventory, but a lot of undifferentiated inventory, the higher your ratings guarantees, the more that you can then reallocate budgets.
Right. And then switching over to just streaming services and obviously, you mentioned these new ad tiers that have been created for Netflix and Disney Plus as well. And all the existing and then new to the world, FAST platforms. Can you talk a little bit about basically how much of the bandwidth of the revenue that those platforms are taking of the advertising pie relative to, let's say, linear?
Yeah, I mean, they're still relatively small in terms of the overall, you know, mix of budgets. Someone like Hulu clearly is really important. They have been around for a while. It's scaled, it's high quality, premium. I tend to think of most of the rest of the inventory, Pluto, Tubi, et cetera, as something closer to like syndication, or what syndication was 10 and 20 years ago, meaning nobody's budgeting for that as their first dollar down. Right. It's hard to know how much duplication you're going to get. And it's mostly pretty undifferentiated inventory. It's still ostensibly premium, but it becomes a tertiary place to spend money.
Right. And but do you see that there's an increase in that allocation, though? I think I read that one third of new subs for Netflix are now going to this the ad tier platform.
Well, Netflix is tiny. There's just not much money there because there's not very many subs. If they have 1 million in the United States, that's total. That's not at one time.
Right.
That's not to say there's not a lot of interest in it, but they're not a meaningful player at this point. It doesn't mean they can't be. It's just they don't have many actual subscribers on the ad tier.
And so, very high CPMs from what I've read in the, especially for some of the live events that they're doing, just extraordinarily high.
Well, understandably, when they have so little inventory, they can charge a price because the demand is high. And they know they can. Why not? If you're them, you would too. But no, they're not. They're not like. There's no scale in that yet. You have to. Even in a world where, maybe they get to a world where 20% of their subs are ad supported. I mean, that's going to take a couple of years to get to that.
Right.
At that point, again, they're still small. Inside the United States. Now, the big opportunity for them overall is that doing this globally and, you know, a few hundred million here, a few hundred million there, and pretty soon you're talking real money. And it's not to say it's not a real business for them. It's not to say it's not meaningful, but in context of the US television industry, it's not terribly impactful because it's, unless you believe that they're just going to flip everyone to an advertising tier, which isn't going to happen.
Right. Well, absolutely not. Then particularly just I think the customer experience is not always optimal for some of these ad supported tiers. A lot of duplication within the pods themselves that I've seen. So it's not they haven't like completely cracked the code yet.
Oh, it's a long way. I keep getting all these Spanish language commercials for various products I'm clearly not the target for while I'm watching Bloomberg on a connected TV app.
Right.
No, I mean, you know, here's the thing. There, what passes for premium television in the United States, for the most part, is not ad supported, except for what runs on broadcast, and none of that has broad reach. And so it's one of the reasons why there's a real problem with television. It's why I don't think you should ever expect television to grow again, frankly, as an advertising medium. And by television, I mean, including connected TV, include like together as a premium video that's ad supported is not a growth business.
Well, say more about that, just to get a better understanding of that's a pretty big.
I've been arguing this for several years, so it's not new to anyone who's been following me, I think, but no, I mean, basically, there's only so many advertisers who need what television delivers. And unless you believe, if you believe the economy will continually produce large brands who differentiate themselves on the basis of awareness of their attributes, who exist in oligopolistic categories, and who, you know, are not what you call digital endemics in terms of their orientation, the economy doesn't produce new Procter & Gambles, right? If it did, then you'd have a lot of growth in television, regardless of audiences.
Right.
So, but you don't have a lot of catalysts to cause other advertisers to make what we'll call television, however you want to define it, the dominant medium for many marketers. That doesn't mean it's not an important medium to support the goals for a lot of existing advertisers. But remember, 200 advertisers are 90% of network TV and 60% of all TV. Some of those swap out of TV altogether over time and they get replaced by others. But collectively, you know, they're not increasing their budgets on television. So audiences are completely independent of this, of course. It's got nothing to do with the audience because last I checked, audiences don't buy advertising. And so if you believe that advertisers who depend on television are diminishing and the allocation to television is diminishing for those advertisers because of its relative effectiveness relative to other media as it's perceived, then you don't shouldn't expect growth.
Right. So so at an enterprise level, Fortune 500 level of firm investment in advertising, that's the piece that's shrinking. But there's also like
total advertising can go up. Total advertising can go up, but it doesn't go to TV.
Right. So yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about just the allocation and the fragmentation of that spend, right? Which I mean, obviously, a lot of it has gone to social. Although I think we see some movement, at least kind of some pinging between the different platforms, but then also some maybe going, you know, to programmatic, CTV, these type of things. Talk a little bit more about how you see that shaking up from a budget allocation from an integrated marketing campaign standpoint.
Well, and it varies certainly by advertiser, but it's safe to say that platforms that we'll call digital tend to be still taking share. Now, it is important to note that if you define YouTube as TV, and let's go down the continuum, if you define video that runs on TikTok as TV, now you get to something that could actually be growthy, but most people wouldn't define that as television, right? Certainly video is so ubiquitous that video based ads are increasingly important and continue to grow, but no one's going to call a video ad on Instagram television, right? It's just a video asset. So digital and television are basically where 80-90% of budgets go. And premium content, which is what I think of when I think of television, that's where the shrinkage is.
And then just in terms of how advertisers are using data technology to optimize their audiences, how do you see that? I mean, we started talking a little bit at the beginning about measurement, but what are your thoughts on and the best practices that you've seen as of late?
Yeah, continuing to invest is the best practice because nothing's ever going to stand still. And that what the specific thing that a given advertiser should do is harder to say. You say data and technology. Well, there's always been data and there's always been technology. There's always more data and there's always more technology. So, you know, the simplistic best practice is keep on keeping on, need more.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think just with just a marketing mix modeling and which has always been kind of a very complicated thing to onboard to even like large enterprises. Do you see any big changes in how those firms are approaching their modeling and then obviously their buying decisions as a result of that?
I don't know. You know, I keep thinking that more and more marketers are in on the joke around marketing mix modeling. You know, the idea that port your data long enough, it'll tell you anything you want it to. That's not to say there's not an important use for marketing mix modeling or media mix modeling. In that, you know, if all decisions are not about making good decisions, but avoiding making bad ones or making better ones than you otherwise would make, you know, I think that remains a very real use case for any of these tools, but there are limitations that, you know, the more sophisticated the marketer, the more time progresses, the more people understand that, well, you know, there are still so many flaws and limitations in these tools and in the underlying data for that matter. I mean, truth in data from advertising is not a thing really. It's just you have to understand what the data really means, and then it's as much art as science.
Right. And what about like just from the standpoint of things like data, like brand safety and other consideration sets that you've seen advertisers kind of put more emphasis on, especially as some of their buys are going more digital, so they want to make sure that they have safety around their brand, but also maybe around just the data that's collected and all these things. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think brand safety certainly has to become more important as more and more inventory is transacted programmatically. And because you end up transacting programmatic buying and audience-based buying don't go hand in hand, but it certainly lends itself towards more audience-based buying. As you do more audience-based buying, you are kind of not caring as much about the content in the way that you used to. And therefore, the only way to make sure that you're not buying content that you're going to regret because of the public shame or otherwise is to make sure you're investing in brand safety tools or brand suitability tools for that matter. Right. And then, of course, you want to avoid all the fraud that's out there. And so, yeah, the providers of services around brand safety, brand suitability, verification, fraud, like it's only growing in importance.
Right. Also, I've seen more instances of, obviously, there's a lot of automation in terms of the buying, right, with programmatic. I mean, that's what it is, obviously. But kind of these AI co-pilots that help you plan out campaigns, optimize the campaigns at a much kind of deeper level. Do you think that's going to help to solve kind of some of these endemic issues about these buys and just kind of like the black box aspect of them?
Well, it's a different kind of black box, right? I mean, it's ultimately what's driving the rules that
that's true.
AI tools. No, I mean, it's just
there's no free lunch. Yeah.
Well, and there's nothing wrong with it necessarily. I mean, it's I think that because there's so many different ways you can look at data and analyze data, can use tools that help you do it in a more automated fashion, and can you then look at more data to inform those decisions? I think it's just a natural progression. But at the end of the day, it's also possible to make a better decision with different thinking. And so it's not necessary to use these tools. But I think that there are going to be categories of marketers where applying a ton of data makes a meaningful difference in terms of whatever the KPI that you're trying to track against. And definitely, like, take travel as a category, right? There's so much data that exists. These businesses create online travel agencies have nearly closed loops. Why wouldn't you use as much data as you could? And those lend themselves really well towards using artificial intelligence wherever possible and improving the algorithms behind them on a continuous basis.
Right. So, and then in terms of, especially going back to your role kind of in your consultancy currently, what kind of advice would you generally give investors and industry insiders about how they should approach decision-making within the sector, and maybe, specifically within upfronts, but then just more generally, do you have any kind of general guidelines that you provide? I mean, if you're like a new private equity shop that's trying to kind of get into the sector, what are the things that they should, what are the watchouts and things that they should be mindful of when they're looking to invest?
I mean, it just depends on the specific situation, right? I mean, I don't know. I guess the one thing is just don't assume that anything anyone says is correct unless you've validated it yourself. That's maybe the most important point, because I've one thing I learned when I went from being a banker and analyst to working in the agency world was there's so many truisms. They're just spoken, but don't have any root in reality necessarily. Take the notion of the consumer's in control, right? I mean, I'd hear that when I showed up in agency land. And it's like, so you're saying that's a new thing, where you're saying like consumers are more in control now than they used to be. Like they couldn't just walk away from the media they were consuming. They couldn't stop. Is that what you're saying? Or like, what do you mean by that? Or like, the point is that, people rely a lot on anecdotes and what sounds good. And so I guess it's just always important to make sure you know where the data is coming from that relates to the question at hand.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good rule of thumb. How about for the upfronts, I mean, looking out into the future, how do you see them remaining the way they are right now? Or do you see big changes coming up in the future in terms of how those are structured?
I mean, again, upfronts exist as a way to secure something scarce that's still useful. do you think television is going to remain scarce and scarcer, frankly, as audiences diminish and still useful? Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, if you had a world where nobody cared about what television does uniquely well, building awareness of brand attributes, for example, with sight, sound, and motion, if marketers stopped existing or competing on that basis, then, and you know, or if you only had one company in a given category like that, there'd be no competition for that scarce inventory. And then you wouldn't really have much of a need for it.
Right. I mean, I was also thinking just in terms of the measurement currencies as well. I mean, do you, if you had to put on your projection hat, right, what do you think is going to be happening there? I see, obviously, there's some competition, some, you know, obviously, there's always been multiple ones, but what do you see that, how do you see that shaking out?
Well, I think Nielsen certainly remains in a very strong position. For all of its flaws, it's still better than the alternative for the most part, for what it is that most of its customers want it to do. And I think if there was no measurement, that wouldn't change meaningfully the utility of upfronts. I mean, people would find ways to measure. So long as Nielsen exists as a relative gold standard, which it is, it will remain the baseline for things like guarantees. Although talk about archaic, you know, you could argue the idea of the guarantee is itself kind of an archaic thing. No, because marketers should be able to self-insure. And yet it's just a convention that persists because marketers tend to prefer it. Okay, if you're going to have guarantees, you need a standard against which that guarantee is measured. And Nielsen remains in a very strong position for it.
Yeah. And then just kind of closing up a little bit, what are you, so I always ask this of every guest that we have is there a recent book, film, or piece of content that has inspired you recently and you would like to recommend for our audience?
Oof. Do I have a recent one?
And it can be anything. It doesn't even have to be about like the industry. It could be about anything that
I know. I'm enjoying The Diplomat right now. But it doesn't.
Oh, that's a good show. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have to say, it's just continually learning is you know, by, well, how about this? MadisonWall.substack.com. How's that for a recent reading?
That's good. There's some very good content in there for sure. I'd highly recommend it. So how would people contact you if they wanted to reach out about your consultancy or anything else?
Brian@madisonandwall.com.
Great. Just any other parting thoughts you might have for our audience?
No, just always, like I say, always question everything. And if you need help doing that questioning, people hopefully know where to find me.
You know where to go. Come right. All right. Well, it was fantastic to have you on the broadcast, Brian. Thank you, Brian, for a great conversation today. We hope you enjoyed today's episode of Working Media. Thanks for listening. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen, and share the podcast with other marketers. This is Rafael Bracero signing off. Until next time.